While most singers, songwriters, and music enthusiasts prefer listening to music over classifying its various forms, Vanderbilt sociologists Jennifer Lena and Pete Peterson have attracted scholarly attention for research in which they analyze 60 musics. They find four distinct genre types: avant-garde, scene-based, industry-based, and traditionalist. Their research, titled Classification as Culture, was published in the prestigious American Sociological Review. Recently, I spoke to the professors about these intriguing findings. What was the impetus for this research, Classification as Culture? Is it building on some previous work?
There's certainly been a lot of work on music genres, but the work on genres has been just doing one genre at a time. And so you have a lot of histories of genres, but nothing that looks at what we were interested in, which is how music systematically changes over time. It's clearly true that a person who likes a particular kind of music is often likes that music, popular music, over their entire lifetime, but their kids won't. Their kids will think it's old-fashioned, it's for the parents or whatever. And so when you look at it, music is changing over time, just as people do. And we wanted to systematically look at that and see if we could see patterns in how they change.
I think what Pete is speaking about, the second part here, that music itself changes, is really important. And it's not something we usually notice. So the music that we love from our childhoods, it stays in our memory as the music of that moment. But of course, it still lives on. New listeners listen to it. People try to recreate it. Artists go on reunion tours. And so it does have a life other than the one in our memory. And that was the life that we were interested in charting.
So what you're saying is I might have a different interpretation about music when I hear it than my son does.
Most definitely.
Yes.
Because I was at a different age when I first heard it.
Mm-hmm. And the music probably has changed as well. I mean, what is called the same kind of music probably has evolved itself.
Rock is a really convenient example because rock music, when most of us started to listen to it, we might have associated it with the Beatles or with Elvis Presley. And then if you were introduced to rock in the 70s, maybe you thought of rock as David Bowie or as punk music as a form of rock. And then if you were introduced to rock music now, maybe you think of it as something that's like alternative rock, that's more metal sounding and much less folk sounding than that in the 60s. But they're all rock music. They're all united in a family. And so the music itself is clearly changing.
So this means that when you listen to a radio station that plays oldies, their oldies could be a different concept than the oldies for our parents were.
Yeah, it's very interesting that what goes on an oldie station has changed a tremendous amount, yes.
And I guess technically then an oldie song, say from the 50s, it's not going to be really as popular forever.
Right, right.
Because it's going to be mostly those people that grew up listening to that, mm-hmm. and then people that remember it.
That's right, yes.
Although music gets a second life from time to time as new listeners get inspiration from old music. And technology now has changed so that we can incorporate old music into new music using a process called sampling. But sometimes the inspiration is more indirect, and so the music that was popular in the 50s, in your example, could really inspire new creativity today.
So with this research, Classification as Culture, my understanding is you've come up with four different genre types.
Yes, we found four different kinds of ways that music is organized. We found that some were what we call avant-garde genres. That is, they were just liked by a few people who were terribly serious about the music and were creating something, and often creating something directly in opposition to another kind of music. And then there is something we call the scene-based genres, and that's where you have the avant-garde has evolved into a whole set of people who are like the music but are like in local clubs and in small record stores and in small record companies and so on. But they're very devoted to it as well, but the circle is getting much broader. Sometimes that kind of music is adopted by the major music industry, where it becomes much more, we call, industrial-centered in its orientation. And so in each stage, it is changing, and the number of people who like it change a lot. So in that stage, there's a tremendous amount of people who like it. And then it becomes a fad for them, and soon they drop that fad and go into something else. But there is an afterlife, you might say, for some genres, which go into the form of organization we call traditional music, where people become very concerned about getting it just right and figuring out, no, this goes and that doesn't go, and these people belong in the genre and so on. And so people are like collectors, but they at the core, they're very passionate about that particular tradition and either making it stay absolutely unchanged or changing in particular ways.
It can be kind of hard to keep these separate, and I think listeners will be familiar with the idea of each stage if maybe we boil it down into a word or two. So the first stage of avant-garde, that's like your classic garage band playing out of mom and dad's basement.
Would Elvis have been avant-garde at one time, or did he skip?
No, he didn't skip at all. The sort of environment he came up in was very much a group of people trying to make music and trying to make something that was different than pop music and different than country music and was more what they felt. And so there was an explosion of people, of young kids, who got very excited about that, and a few business people who were empathetic with that and saw they could make money out of it. So very quickly they developed that kind of music as rockabilly.
So there was the Memphis scene.
Yes, right.
So that
developed. See, but then Elvis, came to Nashville, became a national guy, became into movies, and we're getting much more into the industrial sort of scene.
By the time he passed away, was his considered traditionalist, or was that later?
Obviously, you pick an artist who has is a tremendous dynamic to his life. So certainly his fans went into the final stage of where he had to reproduce what he had done before and have just the right the right sounds going with it and sound just like he should, and they wanted to preserve him that way, as they still do now, in impersonators. So that's a form of the traditional phase we were talking about.
And the Beatles, I guess they were considered rebels when they started.
Yes, right.
I think there's a little bit of a danger here in talking about specific artists too much. I think it's helpful to fit artists into these categories to illustrate what the categories mean. But the idea is really to look at how big sets of artists work together and collaborate. And there's a danger in selecting out really important artists as representative of the category, because these people that we're talking about, Elvis and the Beatles, they had such an unconventional experience, so exceptional in so many different ways that
they were really mega.
Yes,
mega
right.
People.
They get beyond the classification of what generally goes on. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe we could talk about some more general examples about music. I mean, could we talk a little bit about, say, country music coming out of Nashville?
Yes, and I think we need to make it clear that when we say genre, we don't mean something like country music. We mean the various different styles of country music. And these styles come and go, honky-tonk and Nashville sound and country-politan and the Nashville rebels and so on. These are all sort of distinct genres in our terms. But as Jen was saying, they form a kind of family because they relate to each other in interesting ways.
Is there any impact from what gets played on the radio? Does that affect what type of music is coming out and
well,
being
certainly,
produced?
Certainly the radio is vital in merchandising the music and getting so that people know, what's being produced and so on. So if music doesn't get heard, doesn't have an opportunity to get very really popular. It could get popular within a local scene, but doesn't get beyond that.
One of the things that might be interesting is to compare how radio facilitated artists hearing each other and being inspired by one another in the first half of the 20th century with the role that maybe satellite radio or the internet plays today. And I think in both cases, it's possible for very small groups of people to hear and inspire one another to form their own scene-based genre because the technology facilitates it. And so we can think about radio playing both roles, the one that Pete spoke about mm-hmm. as a way of measuring the presence of a industry-based genre because it produces sales and visibility for artists, but also as a technology that can facilitate the artists getting together and forming a scene.
Mm-hmm. Now with MySpace, too, I suppose that obviously would have an impact on the number of people listening. And
you know, our study really took up the 20th century, and we did that so we would have a sort of a complete set. But there's a real interesting question whether things have fundamentally changed with the sorts of things that you're now talking about, such as MySpace. And that's an open and exciting question.
Can you give any examples of where you have music that maybe does not go through these stages of avant-garde, scene-based, industry-based, and then traditionalist?
Sure. I think that one of the most interesting things that we found was that there were a number of musics that were created inside the walls of music companies, record companies. Soul music is the example that I think Pete and I love the most. And the reason why this discovery of new music being created in these circumstances is so exciting is because the conventional wisdom is that the music made by record companies is overproduced, maybe not very creative. And so we have a whole set of genres, of which soul is one, where creativity is actually fomented inside of these record companies. There are also a number of genres that haven't been able to sustain a kind of heritage movement. They haven't found a set of committed performers who continue to play the music and do reunion tours. They haven't attracted very much interest from academics. And
I know you mentioned disco, I think, when I was reading your study. And that's one that's not gone through all the stages, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons, correct me, Pete, if I'm wrong, one of the reasons that that happened with disco is that disco, almost immediately after its birth, instantly inspired a whole set of things that we now consider distinct music.
Yes.
Rap music is one of those, electronic.
sort of ironic, but rap is really very much, very closely related to disco. Although, you know, superficially you might say they're different. Much of the way the music is put together is very similar.
So what happened with disco, though?
Well, there was I think most people remember, most people my age and older remember the moment when disco records were brought into a baseball stadium and burned, sort of in this collective rejection of the music. And so part of what happened to disco is that there was just sort of a movement of people away from that set of tastes and that kind of lifestyle that it suggested. But it's also the case that performers migrated into new collections of ideas and inspiration. And so there was a movement of some of the gay DJs in New York and Chicago to develop the music that we now call house. And we don't want to confuse that with the disco that preceded it. It's a distinct thing, but there's a really strong influence there. And so you might think of the end of disco as both a rejection by former fans and a kind of seeping out of performers into these new pools of creativity.
I know when I listen to Lightning 100 sometimes, and they'll talk on their retro show, they'll almost, when they talk about disco, it is almost like talking about sort of a subversive group or type of music that maybe really wasn't quite up to the other standards, or kind of they were putting you in this category if you
were
listening
to disco. Well, disco was unlike other musics. Most of the pop music of the time were very much male-dominated, where disco was women had a very important place in it, and gays and blacks had a very important place in it. So that when Jen was talking about the record burning, that was, you know, a young white male hostile act. So music really does get involved. It's not just accidental what people like, but it has a lot to do with the associations of that music and the symbolic meaning that it has for people.
So overall, looking at your study, what would you say would be the significance of this for people in the music industry to think about?
You know, I suspect that music industry people will react the way that any music expert will, which is to appreciate the synthesis of a lot of different ideas that haven't yet been gathered together. And so we each, music experts, we each have areas of expertise and music that we know much less about. So although we may know the history, the trajectory in our language of the music we love most, here's an opportunity, we give readers an opportunity to think beyond their own experience and see similarities and differences across 60 different kinds of music made in America. And I think that speaks powerfully to these similarities and differences, to the amazing creativity that we have in our nation and how successful we've been in supporting and nurturing it. And I think that that's an important lesson for music industry experts and music fans and public policy experts, that we really have a very important cultural resource here that needs to be protected. And protection means allowing it to flower in many different places.
Pete?
I certainly would agree with Jen that the industry people obviously are interested in the next big thing. But the question is, how does it come? Where does it come from? And so we're suggesting that it comes from music scenes, that there are clusters of people who are working on something, and it will be precisely not just slightly different, but it will be seen as a radical break with the pop music of the time. And so that the inventive industry person is the one that can go out and see music that is quite different, often music which he or she does not like, initially at least, and to learn what it is that gives meaning to that music. And I think the example of rap would be a very good example. Here's a kind of music which was really very different than other things. And it took a good while for people to begin to understand what the music was about and what it was trying to say, and the ranges of things that it meant.
Jennifer Lena is an assistant professor of sociology. Pete Peterson is a professor of sociology emeritus, both at Vanderbilt. Read more about their research in the June 2009 issue of Vanderbilt View. Just click on www.vanderbilt.edu/Vanderbilt View. For Interview, I'm Emery Dear Owens.